17. The Case That Wouldn't Die. The Hodson Murders Revisited. 2012 to 2015. Paul Dale's trial for allegedly lying to the Australian Crime Commission began in Melbourne's Supreme Court in March 2013. After Gobbo's withdrawal as a trial witness, many of the 23 charges against Dale were dropped. Dale's barrister, Geoffrey Stewart, branded Gobbo the Baroness of Treachery during the trial. Stewart had no idea that she was a registered police informer, yet he rightly described her as an excuse for a lawyer. The trial testimony was telling for other reasons. It revealed fresh insights into old gangland goings-on. The European, the supergrass helped by his once lawyer Gobbo to roll on Carl Williams, Farouk Orman and others, gave evidence that Dale was working for us before 2004. He said Dale's information to Williams was always on the money. In a 2009 statement tendered at the trial, George Williams described many meetings between his son and Dale. Usually, Gobbo received a call from Dale asking Carl to call him, George said. Williams Sr. found it a bit strange that Gobbo seemed to be going out of her way to assist Dale's desire to meet his son. Despite these sensational allegations, a jury found Dale not guilty of all charges on the 28th of March. On hearing the verdict, Gobbo was said to scream down the place with disappointment. Dale was free, but puzzled. As he wrote in his 2013 autobiography, "To this day, I don't understand why Nicola Gobbo crossed to the side of the prosecution rather than the defence. I can only wonder if the police had something on her to make her do it." Losing the trial galled police investigators. Like the aborted murder trial, internal feuding had blighted this prosecution of Dale. The quest to convict him was again sacrificed to the need to preserve the Gobbo secret. But there were consequences beyond the bubbles of police intrigue. Legal observers had wondered about the decision to grant Gobbo leave from testifying after a threat. Among them was high-profile solicitor Rob Starry, a friend of Dowsley. The irony is that the pursuit of Dale through Gobbo's illicit recording would condemn her and Victoria Police to a decade or more of examinations into their own possibly criminal conduct. The Hodson children have never grieved properly. They are all still locked in limbo. Nikki Komiazik's handwritten pleas to various authorities for answers, dozens of them over the years, fill folders with lines of confusion and loss. Nikki and her sister Mandy Hodson are easy to like. Both cry readily, but mask their brittleness with humour. Their mother went out with a bang, Mandy told a stranger over a cigarette in 2019. She cannot erase the memory of her mother's face, frozen in a permanent scowl as her body lay in the open casket. This was why Mandy and Nikki agreed to meet Nicola Gobbo in a South Bank cafe in Melbourne's Arts District in 2011 or 2012. Komiazik welcomed any interest in her parents. Everyone else had moved on, as if the mystery had dimmed. But Komiazik still thought of her parents in the moments before she fell asleep each night, drinking glasses of champagne together. Komiazik knew nothing about Gobbo's secret life. When they met, Komiazik was struck by the obvious, tall, blonde, assertive. Gobbo offered the sisters strategies in their quest for a coronial inquiry. Possibly she was motivated by guilt. Maybe she thought there was a dollar in it. Or perhaps she couldn't shake her old habit of running towards the flames. Komiazik recalls a turn in the chat when Gobbo boasted about driving her black Mercedes. She ended up saying that the police aren't allowed to come anywhere near her, Komiazik says. She said she could run any red light in Victoria and they wouldn't pull her over. Gobbo was bragging about the perks of informing to those who had suffered because of her informing. If bystanders couldn't be privy to her powers, Gobbo could at least allude to her hidden influence. Perhaps Gobbo already knew that police brass would not allow her to give evidence at the Hodson's coronial inquest, should an inquest be agreed to. Victoria Police's reputation was inextricably wedded to the keeping of her secret. The Hodson's crusade for a coronial inquiry turned into an exercise in dashed hopes. The 2014 hearing only mashed an already tattered web. A journalist informed the hearing that Roberta Williams had told him her ex-husband fabricated the story that Dale had ordered the hit. The court heard that Tony Mockbell had financed the murders on behalf of Dale, in part because they shared corrupt information from the days when Dale was stationed at Brunswick Police Station. Dale denies having known Mockbell during the gangland years. Andrew Hodson was grilled on whether he had, wittingly or otherwise, explained to the killers how to get into his parents' home. Here were more speculations built on little evidence. The suspected hitman, Rodney Collins, was excused from testifying. So was Nicola Gobbo. The Victorian Government Solicitor's Office, on behalf of Police Chief Commissioner Ken Lay, wrote to Coroner Ian Gray on the 9th of April 2014, asking for Gobbo to be excused on safety grounds. The letter represented the fourth time Gobbo would avoid answering questions about the Hodsons in the witness box. In seeking to protect her and the force's image, Victoria Police once again stymied the pursuit of truth. Gray had to follow the facts, and he didn't have enough of them. In his open finding, he neither accepted nor rejected the police argument that Williams, Dale, and Collins were behind the hit. The truth of the Hodson killings had been apportioned, bargained over, and solicited so many times that distorted theories had emerged in its place. Gray did find that Williams and Dale met 9 days before the Hodson killings, the so-called Hillside meeting. But he could not conclude, given Williams as the sole source was unreliable, that they had arranged a murder. He also found that Terry Hodson should have taken greater precautions to protect himself. Despite the Hodson children's submission that Victoria Police failed to protect their parents, the confidential police submission to the inquiry set out Gobbo's 2004 use of burner phones, her liaising with Mockbell and Williams, and her conflicted status as everybody's lawyer. The revelations, a sliver of the bigger Gobbo saga, would appear in the Herald Sun in November 2014, after Dowsley got hold of a copy of the submission. The coronial finding only compounded the Hodson children's despair. Some former and some serving police officers share the sentiment that too many aspects of the Hodson killings have been deliberately withheld from the light. Outside the court, Nikki Komiasek declared, "It is my belief that Victorian police and the Victorian government are avoiding a royal commission at all costs. And I feel sorry for anybody ever coming into witness protection or to become an informer. I'd advise you, don't do it, because your life's not safe." The Hodson children accept the prevailing view that Rodney Collins killed their parents. Mandy Hodson speculates that he wore a police uniform to gain entry, as he did to kill Raymond and Dorothy Abbey in 1987. Sister Nikki encountered Collins by chance at a Lilydale supermarket not long after her parents' deaths. Collins knew her partner, Peter. Sporting white track pants and a reptilian leer, Collins applied the standard underworld greeting. "Are they the police leaving you alone?" Collins' casual evil deserves its own book. He was thought to have killed 9 people and was jailed for life for murdering the Abbeys in May 2010. Inside, Collins, like everyone else, had tried to join the queue to swap criminal secrets for money. His price for information on the Hodson killings was $1 million. Collins offered questions instead of insights. He sought to manipulate investigator Sol Solomon, and no deal was made. Was he making mischief when he appeared to suggest that more than one person went to the Hodsons' home on the 15th of May 2004? But who was the person that was behind that known or trusted person that followed him in? He said. Komiazik blanches at the memory of meeting Collins, but her enmity towards Gobbo lies deeper. The family wants Gobbo charged with crimes over their parents' deaths. Their open anger towards her is matched only by that of Roberta Williams. She's the master puppeteer, Komiazik says. She's dangerous. She's a very dangerous woman. She seems to have her finger in every little thing and no accountability. Despite a royal commission, Gobbo has never been properly questioned about her improper proximity to the Hodson deaths. When Petra detectives wanted to treat her as a suspect, they were informed by police command that they could not. Indeed, the unit was shut down shortly afterwards. "I'll haunt them," Chrissy Hodson said in defiance just before she was killed. And she did. Chrissy Hodson haunts everyone who cares for justice, including investigators and journalists. She haunts Nicola Gobbo too. The Hodson murder mystery clings to her like a dag on a sheep. Paul Dale declined to give evidence at the Hodson's coronial inquest. He had previously hit problems in the witness box, though not always for criminal reasons. His family suffered from his admissions of infidelity in court, he says, and he cringes each time he reads about his sexual liaison with Gobbo in the press. When Dale was charged with the Hodson murders in 2009, he spent 8 months in solitary confinement in the Acacia unit of Barwon Prison, alongside the hardened criminals he once tried to put in jail. Dale says his time in solitary changed him. He developed a mental disorder. The atrocious behaviour of Victoria Police is why he will be forever medicated. His bull-necked pugnacity did not appear to suffer, though, since he acquired the accused former detective honorific in the mid-2000s. He has strived to recast his reputation. He has quietly reached out to selected journalists to shape their coverage. More recently, in 2019, he has submitted to cross-examination by barristers seeking to trip him up. They don't intimidate him. There is something compelling about Dale's insistence on being heard, and he has now published 2 books to tell his side of the story. If he feels drained by the process, Dale still wears that country boy pride of a family that has always thrown itself into town events. His mum, Jenny, was there for the indignities, the shackles, and the red jumpsuits. She was her son's loudest cheerleader. Dale is a tricky study, chatty, open to scrutiny to a point, and strident about the pain of his wife and children. His sense of having been robbed is genuine. His vehemence invites a middle line, where he might have made poor choices but did not commit murder. Holes litter any prosecution of Dale, but holes also dot his defence. Dale acts like another casualty of a jangled time when rules were broken and suspicions masqueraded as facts. He points to his main accusers, Terry Hodson and Carl Williams, and rightly raises questions about their credibility. Those questions will never be answered now, because both were murdered. According to Dale's version, a conspiracy of police, criminals, and Nicola Gobbo set out to frame a hapless victim. Yet he isn't as hateful of Gobbo as you might expect. He feels sorry for her, because it's clear she was coerced by police. "I wouldn't have gone near her with a fucking 10-foot pole, he says, if he'd known she was a police informer. But he says it lightly, as if looking for a laugh. He wonders at the why. Why did she help police, and why did she breach their friendship when she had so few left? Journalists still come to his home, whose rounded driveway and manicured lawns used to raise questions because of its size and splendor. He sometimes talks to them. The message has never deviated. I am innocent. He has not been convicted, but, as Dale lamented in his 2020 book, Cops, Drugs, Lawyer X and Me, the legacy of his trial by media has meant that most of the public think I'm guilty of something. Long before Paul Dale raged about the injustices perpetrated against him in his 2013 book, Disgraced, Nicola Gobbo had been trying to rebuild. Because she still refused police protection, Victoria Police could not keep her safe. She would not move elsewhere because she trusted only her own doctors for her medical and emotional needs. Police Deputy Commissioner Kieran Walsh was still urging her to go into hiding in January 2012. He judged her risk level to be extreme and resorted to sending her an 8-page manual of personal security advice. New personal frontiers blended with old professional haunts. Gobbo's career was hurtling into reverse. She was back working with Levi Diamond, where she began, alongside colleagues who remembered her as a 20-something-year-old with a fag hanging out of her mouth. Here's the weird thing. Gobbo was still trying to become Victoria Police's all-time greatest informer, even after they'd officially dropped her. She generated hundreds of information reports after she was deregistered in 2009, many times more than some of the most prolific informers in Victorian history. Police had tried to pension her off, and Overland had issued an instruction in August 2010 that Victoria Police stop receiving intelligence from her. But Gobbo didn't go away. She kept presenting herself to offer new criminal insights, and Victoria Police kept listening to her. We know Gobbo's tip-offs to police produced 4, if not more, police information reports in early 2012, 3 years after she was deregistered, and 2 years after former Chief Commissioner Simon Overland ordered his officers to stop. Who was addicted to whom? At the same time, Gobbo was again appearing for Diamond's clients in courtrooms. Then, one day in September 2013, a judge was told that Gobbo couldn't be in court. She was delighted, radiant and a bit tired, the story went. The county court hears excuses every day. For once, here was a no-show that everyone could celebrate. Nicola Gobbo was absent from court because she had just given birth to a baby girl. Gobbo had always liked kids. She appeared to spoil her goddaughters. She learned a lot by babysitting the children of the Chemical Brothers. In 2008, a close friend had gone through IVF treatment. Gobbo followed her friend's example. She had begun IVF treatment soon after being successfully treated for snatch cancer, as she called it, in 2010. Motherhood probably seemed like a natural step, even if her choice of partners often let her down. The fairy tale scripting was true enough, as far as it went. Gobbo had recovered and fallen pregnant. Now she was bonding with her baby daughter and could not represent her client at a preliminary hearing for his upcoming trial on drugs charges. The client, Richard Barco, went to prison for methamphetamine trafficking. Here's where the fairy tale took an odd turn. Normally, the lawyer-client relationship eases in the wake of courtroom machinations. Instead, Gobbo began visiting Barco in jail. Gobbo later had another child, a boy. She told people one or both of her children were fathered by a gay flight attendant. Others were informed she'd chosen her daughter's father through a sperm bank picker face. Yet a lawyer who cited Gobbo during visits to Barco at a maximum security prison heard her tell her daughter, "Say goodbye to Daddy." The prosecution team in Barco's case didn't know about Gobbo's relationship with him, nor did the judge, Richard Maidment, QC. who later stepped down from the bench and headed Tony Mockbell's legal fight against convictions that might have been tarnished by Gobbo. "She told me it was a random selection process, picking faces to vet the donor," says a man who declined to be the godfather of Gobbo's daughter. "She was not telling me about Barco." The flight attendant and pick-a-face stories seemed to be motivated by a desire to protect Barco from jailhouse reprisals for Gobbo's informing. They didn't work. In October 2015, Barco was slashed across the face, requiring 33 stitches. By then, the existence of Lawyer X was a published fact, but her identity was still under wraps. Gobbo had long feared the courts and the criminals would stumble onto her secrets. But soon her secrets would be out, and the entire world would hear them.